This is The Takeaway for Thursday, March 23rd, 2017.
Winning isn't enough, but it's how you win and how much you win. And he recognized this was the time, and he reached out to some people who suggested me. We got together. I've known Donald since the 1980s, and we talked about it, and he felt I could help him as I felt, and he made the changes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And that is the voice of Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager and longtime associate. And Manafort was in the news a lot over the summer. That sound was from back in April when Manafort was arguing his case on TV and fighting a lot of internal battles with other Trump officials behind the scenes. Now, Paul Manafort left the campaign in August. The campaign at that time wasn't going so well for Donald Trump, and Manafort's connections, his very lucrative connections to pro-Russian Ukrainian politicians and Putin-connected Russian oligarchs, were getting too many headlines for Mr. Trump's comfort. Those kinds of headlines are back now, though, and it's not campaign season anymore. Congressional committees and the FBI are now actively investigating Russia's attempts to influence the presidential election. Connections and even possible collusion between Trump campaign officials and Russians is a focus. And once again, Paul Manafort is at the center of the media leaks. Anyway, the Associated Press is reporting this week that Manafort signed a $10 million contract with a Russian billionaire in 2006, intended to advance the interests of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Treasury officials are reportedly tracing Manafort's business transactions with Russians through offshore banks. Now, they call this phenomenon in Washington drip, drip, drip. The news on Manafort and the broader Russia investigation is dripping all over the president and his agenda. There's a major healthcare bill on the House floor today. Matthew Nussbaum is White House reporter at Politico. He's been following all of the story on Paul Manafort. Welcome, Matthew.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Do we know how the investigation into Paul Manafort, his past activities and his possible activities during the campaign, fits into the broader picture? Because Manafort, of course, is not the only Trump campaign official under investigation.
That's right. So we don't yet know how any of this really all fits together. There are a number of Trump associates and Trump campaign officials who have these ties that have been revealed either to Russia or to WikiLeaks, which, as we now know, was leaking documents that were provided by Russia. So all these questions are there. There's a lot of data points out there, but we don't yet know how they all connect. There are two congressional investigations, the FBI investigation, that are all trying to put this together. So there's three investigations, at least, that we know of that are trying to find out if this stuff all connects and how it all connects.
Let's go back in time just for a minute, because Paul Manafort's activities in the campaign are clearly an issue, but his history in Ukraine with pro-Russian Ukrainians and with Russians themselves is probably an issue as well, and this goes back to the mid-2000s.
That's right. So this is a Republican political operative, Paul Manafort, who had worked on a number of presidential campaigns. But then he had these stints lobbying on behalf of foreign governments, particularly the Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian leader there, Viktor Yanukovych. And we know that he received, or at least was slated to receive, large sums of money for this work. And now we know that the work wasn't just confined to pro-Russian forces within Ukraine, but also was done for Russia itself.
And when we flash forward now to President Trump in the White House, there is this sense from Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, and White House officials that they never really knew Paul Manafort all that well and that they couldn't have known about these connections. Listen.
To suggest that the president knew who his clients were from a decade ago is a bit insane. He was not a government employee. He didn't fill out any paperwork attesting to something. There's nothing that he did that suggests at this point that anything was nefarious.
Well, first, it's worth noting that this whole idea that there was nothing nefarious here is a little bit dubious, because when you're lobbying on behalf of a foreign government, you are supposed to register with the Justice Department. And according to the AP, there's no indication that this work that he was doing for this Russian billionaire to improve Putin's image, to improve the Russian government's image, was registered with the Justice Department. But what we're seeing is the White House is trying to run away from Paul Manafort as quickly as they possibly can. Sean Spicer saying earlier this week that he played a limited role on the campaign for a limited time. Of course, he managed the campaign through the convention, through a critical time in the campaign. And we know that when he left the campaign in August, that was not the end of his relationship with Donald Trump. They continued to be in touch, we know, through the election and even into the transition period. So this attempt that they're making to say, oh, he was just a bit player on the campaign, won't work the way it will for some of these other people who have come under scrutiny for their Russia connections.
And what does it mean now as we move forward, Matthew Nussbaum, that Treasury officials are looking into Manafort's overseas transactions through offshore banks?
Well, it just raises more questions. It just puts more of a cloud over the White House, and you have this continued drumbeat, and it's a bipartisan drumbeat. This is not just a Democratic witch hunt the way the White House has tried to make it out to be, for more information and for more investigations. Senator John McCain, who everybody knows, staunch Republican, is calling for an independent investigation. He says that the House Intelligence Committee has lost credibility in doing this investigation. He wants to see an independent committee formed to investigate it. The more information like this that comes out, the more we're going to see Republicans and Democrats alike calling for an independent investigation into what happened here.
Matthew Nussbaum, White House reporter at Politico, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
Well, while investigators in the U.S. are putting together the pieces of Paul Manafort's ties in Eastern Europe and his overseas financial transactions, we thought you might want to hear the sound of Americans caught up in possibly shady overseas Russian transactions. That's the band Red Jumpsuit Apparatus at their live show in Moscow in October of 2013. And they're not money launderers, as far as we know, anyway. But that Moscow tour was financed by money laundered through Eastern Europe's largest documented money laundering scheme, a scheme that came out in the wash this week. It's known as the Laundromat. And between 2010 and 2014, the scheme reportedly moved as much as $20 billion out of Russia and into legitimate bank accounts around the world. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project got its hands on records of over 120 accounts involved in the scheme, documenting how those billions moved around the world. Now, you have to find a legitimate home for dirty money. And this money went into offshore accounts, into accounts in the United States. It bought diamonds in the UK and even financed the European tour of our friends Red Jumpsuit Apparatus that you just heard a minute ago. Drew Sullivan is the editor and co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and he joins me now. Hi, Drew.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, I know it's spiderweb-like, and I know it's complicated by design, but walk me through how this laundromat scheme actually worked.
What happened is that banks in Russia, fronted by some paper companies, transferred about $20.8 billion to Moldova. And they did it through a really clever trick. What they did is they issued very large debt between two companies, and one of those companies would then default on the debt, and then a Moldovan court would order a Russian company to pay that debt to an external company, usually just a paper company. So they used the court order as kind of a means of legitimizing the money.
And then how does the money find its way into a European or an American bank?
Once it was in this Moldovan bank, it was in a bailiff's account in the Moldovan bank. It went out to the various offshore companies that were paid, and then it went to a bank in Latvia called Trashta Commerzbank, which has since been closed for money laundering. And then once it was in Europe, it was able to go all over the world without any serious checks on the money.
So part of the question here is, why resort to all of these transactions? I mean, if you're a rich Russian oligarch or a Russian criminal with lots of money, why not just buy a 20 million pound condo in London or a $30 million apartment in New York City? Why not just buy it? Invest your money that way.
Well, you can't directly, because it's too easy to track down for authorities. And so you have to go through a series of offshores to kind of hide the money. So once you've moved it into offshores, you then have the problem of offshores have a, you know, bad taint to them. And so a lot of banks would check them out very closely. So you need some evidence that it's legitimate money. The whole trick to this whole operation was they had a Moldovan court order saying, hey, see, we were paid this money and the court ordered it, so now we can use it to buy the apartments in London.
What do we know about the Russian sources, the Russian actors involved here? And also, what do we know about the legitimate banks that might have been complicit or had knowledge?
Well, we don't know a tremendous amount where the money actually came from. Where we speculate where the money came from is by looking at where the money went to, who actually spent the money in the end. Because in Russia, it was done through a bunch of offshore companies. And most of those offshore companies were set up in such a way that there's only proxies, people who didn't know that they were actually running these companies. So it was set up in a fairly careful way. The difference that in this between other cases is that we actually got the bank records, which show where the money went. And so we do know that a number of large Russian oligarchs, a couple in the IT sector, we know the Krapovin family, which is very closely connected to Putin and is related to the Russian railroads, spent a large amount of money that came out of the laundromat.
And do any large, ostensibly legitimate banks have something to worry about here?
Yeah, a lot of the money did go to Western banks. And what happens in that case is once you've laundered money, you can then move it to the Western financial organizations and put it in hedge funds and do all the things you do. But where the banks made a big mistake was they didn't know their customer's customer. They knew their customer, but they didn't know who they were dealing with. And in many cases, you know, that left very clear telltale signs that these were not legitimate transactions. If they had done any check on the companies, they would have seen they were clearly paper companies. If they had tracked down the owners, they would have found out that they were, you know, basically proxies. But, you know, banks kind of short arm this a little bit. They do what they need to by law, but they don't go to extreme efforts or even very difficult efforts to check out, you know, where this money is actually coming from.
Right. It's hard to turn away the billions. Well, Drew Sullivan, it's a remarkable scheme and a remarkable piece of journalism to uncover it. But when you read about the laundromat and this money laundering scheme, I mean, the only conclusion that you can reach is this isn't the only one. I mean, they do this because it works. This happens all the time.
No, I mean, we're basically in a situation where we're probably seeing the largest transfer of wealth from poor countries to rich countries. And, you know, in Russia, it's on the order of, you know, $60 billion a year, sometimes up to $200 billion a year has been flowing out of Russia. Russia is not alone. China is also huge amounts of money going out of China, Brazil, most of the developing world. And so this is, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And almost all of this has to be laundered. And this is just one example. It's a unique example because we got such detailed information. But there's literally a dozen or two dozen of these copycat schemes going on right now that are being, again, missed by banks and, again, being ignored by regulators. And, you know, this is where the money of these countries is. It's leaving, you know, the countries that need this kind of development, and it's going into luxury real estate and G6 jets and all these luxury goods, and it's not really helping the people of those countries.
Drew Sullivan is the editor and co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Drew, it's been great having you.
It's great being here.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Senate Judiciary Committee hearings continue today for Judge Neil Gorsuch. He's President Trump's nominee for Supreme Court Justice. And while most of Capitol Hill was focused on the president's wiretapping claims and the struggling GOP health care bill, an important part of his judicial record came up yesterday: students' rights under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
If anyone is suggesting that I like a result where an autistic child happens to lose, that's a heartbreaking accusation to me. Heartbreaking. But the fact of the matter is, I was bound by circuit precedent, and so was the panel of my court. And I had been bound for about 10 years by the standard in Urban versus Jefferson County. Now, Senator, there are other cases where, again, unanimously, my court had ruled for children with disabilities under this law.
Now, what you hear Neil Gorsuch explaining there are opinions in three different cases before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals when he was on that court that all tended to side towards school districts and away from students and their families on questions of their rights under the law. Meanwhile, right around that same time that Judge Gorsuch was before the committee across the street at the Supreme Court, justices ruled unanimously in Andrew F. v. Douglas County School District, setting a higher standard in education for the 6.5 million school children with disabilities across the United States. Andrew F. is a child in Colorado with autism, and his family pulled him out of school after his progress stalled. Then they sued, since the law requires a free, appropriate public education. Regina Skyer is a founder and manager of the law offices of Regina Skyer and Associates. They're a special education law firm, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Todd.
So I said a free and appropriate education, and appropriate is the word that seems most at stake here in front of the court.
We refer to that as the litigated itch. In 1975, Congress passed the Individuals Disability Education Act. In 1975, it was called the Education Handicapped Act, changed names. And it said children with handicapped conditions are entitled to a free, appropriate public education. The statute didn't really give us definition of the word appropriate. It wasn't until 1982 that the United States Supreme Court issues the first decision known as the Rowley decision, which tries to explain what that word appropriate is.
And so what are the justices saying now about what appropriate means? Because Justice Roberts, in his ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts, said we could have a standard that's so low that you call appropriate that kids just languish, or we can have a higher standard that actually means something.
Well, 35 years later, after Rowley, the Roberts Court came out unanimously with a decision that said it's not enough that a child receive an education that is merely de minimis in its appropriateness. We need to see something more. And the language from that statute, from that decision rather, is terrific. Unanimously yesterday, the court said the child's education program must be appropriately ambitious. We took away that term de minimis to ambitious. Goals may differ, but every child should have the chance to meet challenging objectives. This is a higher standard than de minimis, which means trivial, which is what the Tenth Circuit said when they denied Andrew F. relief.
When Neil Gorsuch is still on that court and was part of that ruling. But the court,
I don't believe he was part of that panel.
That panel. Okay, but he does sit on that court.
Correct.
Now, a lot of advocates and people in your position, though, are encouraged by the ruling. They don't think this went far enough. The court has said that the opportunity for education under the law has to be substantial. Many of them would have preferred an equal ruling, that appropriate means it has to be equal to every other kid who's in the school. They haven't said that.
They haven't said that, but they've moved up the ladder. You're right. I would have been far more zealous in what I want the school districts to provide for our children. But at least we have a move in the right direction from a unanimous court. I see you have a question for me.
Well, I do want to know how this ruling, once it comes down from the ivory marble court, affects students directly. Where would the classroom potentially change now for students who are situated in this way?
Can I give you an example of a case that I saw yesterday in my office, which I thought was very intriguing? It's a child with a solidly average level of intelligence, a solid good IQ, cognitive skills were really right there. Had been in special ed in New York City's public schools, identified as a special ed student since third grade, had an IET, an IEP, was in an integrated co-teaching environment, two teachers in the class, a gen ed teacher, special ed teacher, a lot of related services, and even received extra resource room. By the end of eighth grade, although every year he received passing grades, he's now at the end of eighth grade, and the parents are still saying, but we don't see this, that he should have been getting these passing grades. Had him evaluated twice. By the end of eighth grade, this child is reading between a second and third grade level.
And so now that the court has ruled, this would have been accelerated. In other words, the school district would have a higher responsibility.
The school district's burden, they will never be able to say, well, we've given this child a de minimis education. He was able to graduate. He was able to pass social studies. They'll never get away with that.
And if they try, somebody like you goes to court. That's the point here.
Correct. And my entire bar and the special ed advocacy community in the country is happy for this. Yes, it didn't go far enough, but it certainly took us up the ladder.
And briefly, a school district administrator, a superintendent looks at this ruling, and they see their responsibilities how now?
They're frightened. They're frightened about the financial implication, and the justices were concerned about that. School district attorneys raised this in their amicus briefs. They have a greater level of accountability. There has to be more thoughtfulness. Remember, back in 2004, when we reauthorized the IDEA, we changed it to the Individuals Disability Education Improvement Act.
Improvement Act. And that's largely what the court has done here. Regina Skier, founder and manager of the law offices of Regina Skier & Associates, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. A moment of silence was observed earlier today in London after a deadly attack that left at least three people dead and around 40 others wounded. A British-born man who had previously been investigated by British intelligence for connections to violent extremism plowed a car into crowds of people on Westminster Bridge right near Parliament yesterday afternoon. He also stabbed and killed a police officer. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, calling the assailant a soldier of the Caliph. British Prime Minister Theresa May addressed lawmakers today as she vowed that London would move forward united.
Today we meet as normal, as generations have done before us and as future generations will continue to do, to deliver a simple message. We are not afraid, and our resolve will never waver in the face of terrorism.
A message of calm and unity from British Prime Minister Theresa May there. Joining us now from London is Stephen Farrell, staff editor in the London Bureau for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. What do we know about the attacker now and whether this was a lone wolf type inspired actor or somebody who was steered by ISIS directly?
Well, all of that's being figured out at the moment by the police and the domestic security services. What we do know is that all public statements about the actual events were that it was one person involved on the ground, driving a vehicle into a crowd of people on Westminster Bridge, then ramming the car into the railings around Parliament. What we have found out this morning, we all woke up in London to find out that police had raided a number of addresses around the country, and that eight arrests had been made in London and Birmingham, a city in the Midlands, a couple of hours' drive away from London. So nobody, of course, knows what will come of those arrests, but it does suggest that they knew where they wanted to go, they knew who they were looking for very quickly after the event, and we are hearing that the suspect was British-born, but no more than that, other than there was some historic involvement with the security services. They were aware of him.
This is the first attack of significance since the London underground bombing in the summer of 2005. Has London on edge again, or at least sat up to take notice of terrorism once again?
Yeah, I mean, there was a British soldier nearly beheaded. He was murdered on the streets a couple of years back. These things have gone on. It was interesting. Everybody kind of pricked up their ears last year when the outgoing head of the London police said, look, it's a matter of when, not if. So to an extent, the British authorities have kind of been pricing this in, preparing people for it. It didn't really come as a surprise, certainly not after all the attacks on the continent. Pretty much everyone I knew has been walking around London wondering when's it going to come.
The geographic significance of the attack, if people aren't familiar with the map of London, the Westminster Bridge is a location of great import symbolically and for tourists.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're right in the center of London. It is the bridge that runs right underneath Big Ben, the Houses of Parliament. When I ran down to the scene, well, actually, I was on a motorbike. I whizzed down to the scene yesterday, got off right next to Parliament Square, the statue of Winston Churchill outside those grand Houses of Parliament. I saw a red air ambulance parked in the middle of there, and it you couldn't be closer. The police were shouting us, "We need you to get back. We need you to get back. We need you to get back beyond Downing Street." So right there, this is the heart of the British establishment.
It is. Police investigate in the aftermath of a terrorist attack that killed at least three in London. Stephen Farrell with The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
A big vote is set to take place in Lebanon's parliament this week that could repeal Article 522 of the penal code there. That law states that men who rape women can walk free if they marry the victim. In partnership with News Deeply, we spoke with Aliyah Awada of the gender equality campaign group Abad, based in Beirut. She's been working to convince politicians and the Lebanese people that it's time to abolish the law.
Usually when a woman gets raped, the man come and propose. So the family says, okay, it's better for her to get married from him so she can live a normal life and she will preserve her honor and the family honor.
So the woman, the victim, can save her honor by getting married to the man who raped her. What about his honor? Has he sacrificed any honor in this way?
So when we talk about honor in the Arab region, we don't talk about men. No matter what men do, nothing will shame them. It's only the women.
So what has your campaign been like in the halls of legal counsel there in Beirut to try and get this law changed? What has the message been that's come back from lawmakers or government officials to your campaign?
The strategy at the public level where we send very influential messages saying that the rape is a crime and he has to go to jail. This is the first message we sent. The second was the woman has the right to say no. I don't want to get married from the man who raped me once, because if I get married from him, then he will continue raping me my whole life. At the same time, we worked at the policy level with different decision makers, like we have here in Lebanon, the Justice Committee, who was studying abolishing the Article 522 law. After all this set or series of lobbying meetings, we managed to get this draft law to be discussed inside the parliament with different political affiliates. And the final voting will be this week, hopefully by yes, to abolish Article 522.
So that vote is coming up this week and we'll be watching it. Aliyah Awada, your advocacy, of course, is there in Lebanon, but this is a common practice across much of the Muslim world, is it not? Even if it's not codified in law, there are many, many countries where this type of forced marriage or negotiated marriage to preserve a victim's honor, so to speak, is pretty common.
Yes, you're right. We had it in Morocco. In Morocco, we had a woman who called Amina, and she was a victim of this rape marriage law, and she committed suicide after she was forced to get married from the rapist, and she was only 16. And we have it in Egypt, we have it in Jordan, and we have it everywhere. The problem, it's not only the law, Todd, it's all the practices and the traditions at the community level. So when we work on advocacy campaigns and public campaigning, we also work at the community level. We work with the community leaders to say the law is not only the problem, but also our practices. When we start to change our mentalities and our practices, then we can achieve that change we want, not only in Lebanon, but in different countries in the MENA.
And those mentalities and practices are critical, it seems to me. I mean, even if you're victorious here and the law changes, nothing overnight is going to change the dishonor with which a lot of members of the community will see that woman, that victim, after she's raped. She will still suffer in the eyes of many of her neighbors, men primarily, I presume, even if the law doesn't force her to get married.
Yes, exactly. But when we abolish the article and when we change the law, this will help us. Because, you know, Todd, if you know that you will not escape jail if you rape someone, you will think many times before doing your crime. Second, you're totally right. People will still look to this woman, the survivor of rape. They will not look at her as survivor. They will continue looking at her as someone who lost her virginity and who lost her honor. So we will start working on these mentalities. We want to build this army of supporters who can help us to spread the message. The rape is a crime. The woman is a survivor of this crime, and she didn't do anything wrong, and we have to deal with her based on that.
The battle to repeal Article 522 in Lebanon, the law that can absolve rapists of a crime if they marry their victims. Aliyah Awada, an advocacy and campaign manager for Abad, is at the tip of the spear. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Refugees from Syria and other countries poured into Greece in 2015. And when they did, outside money to help and house those refugees did as well. Hundreds of millions of dollars meant to build housing, provide food, secured borders. It all came in, and it's become the most expensive humanitarian response in history. Meanwhile, the news organization Refugees Deeply has traced $803 million that came into Greece from outside organizations and governments. They've also uncovered a stunning figure. Up to 70% of that money appears to have been wasted. Daniel Howden is a senior editor at Refugees Deeply, and he led the reporting for this investigation. And corruption doesn't seem to be the main problem here. Instead, it's what Howden calls criminal mismanagement, where a lot of refugees suffered as a result.
What we've really seen here is enormous amounts of waste. We're talking about a situation in which in some camps you had 40 different non-governmental organizations all running projects simultaneously. Three or four different authorities, so the police, the army, the Ministry of Migration officials, the UN, all simultaneously supposedly in charge of camps. So you've seen enormous duplication and then incredible delays in making relatively simple decisions about how to coordinate and which camps should be prioritized, what should happen at what site and when it should happen.
And does that mean that no one in the Greek government or at one of these organizations or several of these organizations was really in charge? Was there no point person, no minister, no executive who was the point of contact or the final say?
When this happened in Greece, Greece is a sovereign country, it's a European Union member, it has ministries and functions and officials, it's a place with, you know, 4G phone networks, etc. The government was under considerable strain. We hadn't seen these kinds of people flows like we were seeing in June of 2015 onwards. They hadn't been seen before in Europe. So you had a European government, but under acute stress. And then you had big agencies like the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and like the European Union's ECHO, which is its humanitarian operations wing, operating for the first time in a European setting. So it was really hard to work out who was in charge. There was incredible strain on the institutions that were there. And while all of this mess kind of worked itself out and they figured out who was in charge, that period was significantly longer than it needed to be. So it's not fair to say that nobody was in charge. It's fair to say, as many refugees said to me from camps all across the country, was they had been unable to work out exactly who was in charge at any one time. It was incredibly unclear who to talk to. Was it the volunteers who'd come over in record numbers to help out in Greece? Was it the foreign NGOs who were here in very large numbers? Was it the police? Was it the government? Was it the UN? So it really was a case of too many agencies trying to take charge and to act all in the same space.
Can you give some examples of conditions in camps or places where this waste affected the lives of refugees directly?
The investigation that we had began with a 17-year-old Syrian girl called Widad Madrati. I chose to highlight Widad's case because she comes from Aleppo in Syria. There's been a lot of arguments going back and forth. There's a lot of debate about who is a refugee, who is not a refugee. Given the situation in Aleppo, Widad and her family clearly qualify by almost anybody's terms as refugees. In the short time that they were in Greece, arriving in March of 2015, they saw a litany of the worst conditions that one can imagine. I mean, they had arrived in Europe thinking that they'd gotten to safety. The first place that they found themselves is the island of Lesvos in the eastern Aegean. There at the camp in Moria, just a simple registration process where they have to be identified and get the paperwork that allows them to then move on to the Greek mainland. That's been a place where there've been fires, riots, and most recently, three deaths where during the freezing conditions over the winter, people were left out exposed in tents. And some of those people died after burning plastics to try and keep warm. Now, moving on from there, they went to the docks in Piraeus, where there was complete chaos. The state was almost completely absent. Then they traveled north trying to get out just as the borders closed and found themselves in a chaotic open encampment at a place called Idomeni, which is basically just a village close to the border into the Balkans. The borders were closed and they were at Idomeni for a little over 2 months. in a relatively short period of time, 7 to 8 months, what they encountered in Greece was a total lack of information, coordination. They had no idea. They were shifted from pillar to post. They were left in awful circumstances. And yet, constantly, their questions about what was going to happen to them next, what did they need to do? I'm happy to say that Widad and her family today are in Athens and are awaiting transfer over to France. But in such a short space of time, a family that anybody could see are refugees and do qualify for refuge in Europe, got to see the worst of what Europe has to offer in terms of a refugee response.
Daniel Howden, before we let you go, you know, your team writes in this story a popular saying in Greece that they have great laws and lousy governance. Maybe that was at play here. But a crisis is a crisis. The definition is that problems pop up that you didn't expect. Are there any reforms underway here or any substantive changes that will either improve the situation now for refugees as this crisis continues or make this less likely in the future?
What we have seen and what we continue to see is a European approach to this issue that prioritizes stopping people from coming. Now, what we discovered during our investigation was that there were figures at the very highest levels within Europe who, if not happy to see this situation, were certainly found that having a huge mess in Greece suited their ultimate political objective, which was to slow and deter more people from coming this way.
Some incompetence, duplication, certainly waste, and signs of intentional and maybe cynical efforts to keep people from coming to Europe through Greece in the first place. An investigation from Refugees Deeply. Daniel Howden is senior editor there. Daniel Howden, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. All art is supposed to be open to interpretation. And the interpretation that's going on around one new painting at the Whitney Biennial in New York has grown especially confrontational this week. The painting is called Open Casket, and it depicts Emmett Till dead in his casket. It follows a famous photograph showing Emmett Till after he was lynched by whites, after a white woman claimed he grabbed her and whistled at her in Mississippi in 1955. Open Casket crossed from thought-provoking to downright controversial because the artist, Dana Schutz, is white. And some, including fellow artists, say her interpretation is exploitation. They say it appropriates the black experience of a horrible crime. A small group have been trying to block the painting from view at the museum, and dozens of artists have signed an open letter to the museum asking that the painting be removed and even destroyed. Baruti Capano is associate professor and department chair in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. He's co-editor of Soul Thieves, The Appropriation and Misrepresentation of African American Popular Culture. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you've written and edited in Soul Thieves about cultural appropriation of black images and black bodies. How does this painting fit in to that story as you watch these protests?
Well, at least according to some of the artists who have signed on to the letter, they see this painting as part of an historical appropriation of black culture, and part to line the financial pockets of the artist. And another part of their critique, they talk about what they consider the white gaze that remains fixated on the damaged and mutilated black bodies. And finally, I think one of the third major points that the black artists who are protesting make is that media in general continue to propagate images of tormented and distressed black people. So in this particular case, the black body of Emmett Till continues this cycle, and I think that this is the major point of contention for these artists.
The story of Emmett Till, which is a horrific story of a boy who was lynched and murdered because he allegedly spoke to or winked at a white woman in the wrong way, it's a famous American case, became more famous because his own mother demanded that he have an open casket and demanded that the photograph itself be broadcast to the world. I mean, the image of Emmett Till's body is part of what made the case so famous to so many people, and now that image is being appropriated and propagated.
We've had a long line of those images, and I think that I read in the critique from these artists that, first of all, there's the question is who gets to determine that image, who gets to control that image, and at what point is this exploitation? At what point are we showing these bodies of black people, black boys and black men in particular, being mutilated, being destroyed as a form of exploitation, as a form of, in some ways, even reinforcing the image of white dominance by continuing to show white America that we still are in control of black bodies. And I think that is really the essence of the point of the critique. At what point do black people control the stories of black bodies?
Professor, we're talking about the art, and I also want to talk about the protest. Other artists calling for a painting to be removed and artists calling for a painting to be destroyed. I want to be honest with you and say that while I value the protests deeply, the call for a piece of work to be destroyed as part of that protest bothered me deeply.
It bothered me too. And that was literally the first point of contention. And in fact, the letter says that it's not acceptable for a white person to transmute black suffering into profit and pain, and literally calls on the destruction of the painting and the call to not enter it into any other market or museum. I don't believe that's the route that we need to take. I think that we need dialogue. And for a group, however large or however small it may be, to determine by itself what is art, what is acceptable, what images, that's a road. If we're going to go down that road, I think we're going to really, really have problems as a nation. We need to have the conversations. And from what I can see, I'm not sure that the call for the conversations preceded the calls for the destruction of the art.
I want to read you some of Dana Shutt's own words. I know you're familiar with them. The artist says, "I don't know what it's like to be black in America, but I do know what it's like to be a mother. Emmett was Mamie Till's only son. The thought of anything happening to your child is beyond comprehension. Their pain is your pain. My engagement with this image was through empathy with his mother." That's the artist's take.
And at some point, that is to me, that's one of the goals of art. Art is supposed to inspire us into conversation. Art is supposed to inspire us, to elevate us to be better people. And in that sense, I think that this particular work is doing some of that.
And the story of lynching of black bodies has really come to the fore. I mean, America is talking about it more than ever before. Not only this painting, but of course we had Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, and the new movie that's a hit from Jordan Peele, Get Out, which arrives at similar themes. This is in front of America's face now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't think that only one group gets to tell that story. I think one of the things that we just need to make sure, black folks need to make sure, is that our voices, that we are also a part of telling the story, our own vision of that story.
Let me put you in your imagination in that museum, standing in front of the painting, and maybe do two things. One, digest it a little bit and tell me what your imagination says about that piece of work, and then what you might say to the artists and protesters who are standing next to it.
I can appreciate the artist's attempt to keep this memory alive. I can appreciate the artist's attempt to engage us in dialogue. I'm not sure that she imagined this level of controversy.
No.
And to the protesters, I would say, I appreciate their point of view, too, that the images of black people are so precious. And so I absolutely can understand why some of us want to make sure that there is some control of those images. But let's continue the conversation. Let's continue the dialogue. And let's appreciate the importance of artists to take their own unique visions to tell stories that are important to America.
Baruti Capano is associate professor and department chair in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can see that painting for yourself of Emmett Till by Dana Shutt on our website at thetakeaway.org. And finally today, something else on the intersection of art and politics and the question of who has the right to portray what stories. The musical Miss Saigon is back on Broadway tonight for the first time since 2001. It's a show from the late 80s, a love story set in the Vietnam War. As our partner, the New York Times, reported this morning, it's created huge amounts of controversy over the years, in part centered around casting. One of the show's lead men is a half-Vietnamese pimp and was originally played by a well-known British actor, Jonathan Pryce, and they put him in prosthetics and makeup to change his face and color. The outcry around that eventually spawned a new tradition around the show, casting that role with only Asian actors. People still want to talk about how the show depicts Asians with weak women, devious men. Hey, things get better. If you want to feel maybe a little bit better about stereotypes, go back and watch an old production of My Fair Lady. You'll see what I mean. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you for joining us today. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.